Welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. He's Andrew Hansen.
Who are you?
Yeah, I was just trying to change up the intro to be funny. My name's Lauren Fox. Hansen has been watching a lot of high school sports. I've been hanging out with food trucks at McIntyre Ski Area all weekend, or at least that was last weekend. I'm really happy I don't have to do it again this weekend. We had probably 8,000 people come through, went through 34 kegs of beer. That was pretty amazing, but as it turns out, I missed a lot of really cool stuff on the lacrosse pitch field.
Yeah.
The place where they play lacrosse. And on the baseball diamond.
That's right. It sounds like you were involved in a real festival.
It was good. It was Sunday was an amazing day. I'm guessing we had 3,500 based upon dollars that came in and vouchers are redeemed and you name it. So we'll wind up throwing a lot of money at the court appointed special advocates in New Hampshire, which allows kids that are in the court system to get people to advocate for them.
So, oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a very good cause. I have some friends that either are CASAs or are on the board, and I somehow got sucked into this thing and turned into, oh, yeah, hey, you can run this event. So, yeah, so there I was. And the crew at McIntyre Ski Area are absolutely amazing. I didn't have to change a single keg in 3 days. Like, those guys were the ones who were on it, making sure all that stuff got done. But as it turns out, I missed a Bedford High first-round game. I missed a Bedford High lacrosse game match. It was the finale of the boys' seasons and, in some cases, careers. And then you've seen a bunch of other things going on as well.
Yeah. So, speaking of the festival, it was a baseball festival last night. So let's start with that. It's fresh in my mind. It was the semifinals of the state playoffs in Division I, Bedford against Concord down at Holmland Stadium in Nashua. And I was looking for Rick Muntean and seeing the Silver Knights logos. I didn't see him, but it was a great place for a ballpark, great place for the game last night. Stands were almost full, and it was really an outstanding, I call it a classic pitcher's duel.
Yeah.
Bedford wins 1-0. Jeff Mosso has a complete game shutout with 12 Ks, and the opposing pitcher, Griffin Gilbert, had 10 Ks for Concord, and it wasn't until the bottom of the seventh that Bedford scored their only run. But so many impressive things happened during this game, and I want to start with Jeff Mosso on the hill. He comes up as a hitter in the first inning, and bases are loaded, and he gets a fastball out over the plate, and he just misses it. It looked like he got it on the barrel, but he just popped it up to second base. And so frustrating because first inning of the semis, you got the bases loaded. You want to help your cause and get the Bulldogs on the board, but he just misses it and ends the inning. And so now he's got to regroup and go pitch. And sure enough, top of the second, Concord gets two singles. So they got first and second with nobody out. So momentum is starting to trend towards Concord. But what does Jeff do is he turns around and strikes out the next three batters. And then he struck out the side in the fourth, and he struck out the side in the sixth. And it was really fun to watch because he started to pitch so quickly, get the ball, get right back on the rubber.
Right.
I said during the broadcast last night, it almost looked like he was in a rush. It was just one of those pitcher's duel that was classic because it was a 1-0 complete game, but also because of the way the pitchers, they got the ball back and they fought, and he just had this energy that I thought was really contagious when he would, during these innings when he would strike out the side, he started doing these little fist pumps and, physical celebrations that they weren't fist pumps sort of in an intimidating way directed at the other team. They were more just to pump himself up and for the Bulldogs who were watching it, pump up the rest of the team. And it was just a really outstanding performance by Jeff.
Yeah, and we've seen, it's funny, you and I saw it a few weeks ago in one of the games that we did on the air where he looked dominant and then immediately hit a bit of a speed bump in the fourth inning. And he is one, and it was noticeable that day, that when he is locked in, his pace changes. And when he's not locked in and he's trying to find it, it really slows down. And it's, there's a lot more, I'm not going to call it wasted energy, but there's just a lot more time in between breathing where, and I think we all do it to a degree. You pitch and you get the ball back, and if things are on a roll, it's like, all right, who's next? Who's next? Who's next? And I've said it on the air here, and I've said it for years, and you can read it. It's a known fact. Hitting is timing. Pitching is upsetting timing. And if you can get in there and not necessarily quick pitch a hitter, but get him before he's mentally in the frame of mind that he's going to hit, and you set the tempo for the at-bat, and you set the tempo in between pitches so that he doesn't have a chance to forget about the last one, you can really do yourself a favor. And I'm not saying that's what Jeff had in mind, but it's just it's a confidence thing. It's like, if you're rolling, you just want the ball back, right? Let's just go, let's just go, let's just go. You're not thinking about it either.
Yeah, that's exactly what it looked like. I mean, it just looked like he was sort of in his own world, and he was pitching at the pace that he wanted to, and he had energy, and he was, you know, playing off of it. And there was one pitch that was really fascinating to me, because, you know, you think about whether the increased pace could potentially upset the timing of a batter.
Right.
But there was one other potentially unexpected benefit from the pace of his pitching. And here's what it was. It was a 3-1 count. I think it was in the sixth inning. And it was one of those at-bats where he was getting the ball right back on the rubber, making his pitch. And he threw a pitch 3-1 that was, it looked to me like it was maybe a few inches outside. Now, the home plate umpire was consistently calling the outside strike all night. So it was close enough where, you know, if there'd been two strikes, you would have thought the batter would want to swing.
Yeah.
Because it could have been called a strike. But it, to me, it looked like it easily could have been called the ball. But the umpire gave him the called strike. And, you know, it's human nature for umpires to appreciate a pitcher with pitching with this kind of a pace. And, you know, I think it only could have helped for him to get that call. And then he turns around 3-2 with another fastball. I think this was on the inside part of the plate, and gets a strikeout. And it was, you know, just one of those, you know, key moments of the game. And that got Bedford the chance to set up the heroics in the bottom of the seventh.
So the heroics in the bottom of the seventh inning, of course, Grant Levine, as it would happen, I guess, this week, only logically a bases-loaded single that gave Bedford a 1-0 win. In case you missed it, and it's hard to because I've had both of my kids come back and tell me that teachers were talking about Grant Levine in school. Libby telling me that the teacher pulled out a yearbook from way back when and showed them a picture of Grant when he was in elementary school. And Maggie telling me that the PE teacher, who's also Billy Chapman, that Mr. Chapman showed them video of Grant getting drafted. And I don't know if it was MLB TV or what have you, but so it's the kind of thing everybody knows about it. He, weirdly enough, if you weren't locked into the baseball community here, he became a household name in Bedford pretty quickly. If you were a baseball person in Bedford, yeah, you know Grant, Kyle, and Kevin. Like, that's hands down. But it became this household name. It's fun here where everybody has a degree of pride in little things of, oh yeah, I coached this, or yeah, I remember him when he was this old. So I was out behind the batting cage last night, and somebody says, yeah, I told my buddy Grant was 12 and playing in regionals down in Bristol, Connecticut. And I said, watch this. This is a guy to watch. It's not always that easy to project kids. I remember watching Grant when he was 10 and I was umpiring, and I alluded to this when we interviewed him. Hey, this kid's gonna, I don't know what, he wasn't wearing the league issued pants with the elastic that you pull up to your knee like everybody else. He had the George Hendrick pants at 10 years old. It's just things like that, but it's been a great week for them. Family super excited about this. And how do you cap it off? Game winning single on Wednesday night. You're now playing for a state championship. If you want, you can go to Mosso on 4 days rest, but you have other options as well in that pitching staff that you can use. So I know we'll have the game on Bedford 105.1, or at least you will with the crew. I see how it is. I'm going to go leave, come back like Yeah. I'll be there for the game.
Yeah, we got a lot to look forward to for Monday. And, you know, it was really kind of funny how it played out that top of the first batter of the game hit a fly ball to left and Grant made the out. And then, of course, he finished the game with the game-winning single. Of course, you got to give credit to the rest of the Bedford lineup because Zach Fletcher led off the bottom of the seventh with a nice single. And then Nick Mokas laid down a perfect bunt.
That sounds like a very Nick Mokas thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, it was he hit it softly.
Little things.
Towards the third baseman, forced him to make a decision. He decided to throw to second, but Fletcher beat it out. So now you've got first and second, nobody out. Before you know it, Joey Barrett, you know, wears a pitch off his back, takes one for the team to set up the bases loaded opportunity for Grant. And then Grant just absolutely stung that ball right up the middle. Team celebrated by second base with him. Everybody really excited and really joyous moment. So awesome stuff. And then, you know, just so much fun to think about. Of all the places to get drafted, Grant gets drafted by the Rockies. So he's got a chance sometime down the road to maybe be hitting in the hitter-friendly confines of Coors Field.
Yeah. There are worse things. Of course, my wife says, where could he be playing if he signs? And I said, well... And I went through like this, what was probably their minor league system 5 or 6 years ago. But there are some interesting places on that. You have Grand Junction, Colorado, which is rookie ball. Boise, which is short A, the Boise Hawks. You have Asheville, which is low A, which is, I'll say it again, my favorite minor league stadium of any of them, McCormick Field. You have the Advanced A, which is Lancaster, California, which... You think Colorado's friendly, go hit in Lancaster. Double A is Hartford, so he could be a yard goat. And then Triple A would be the Albuquerque Isotopes. Again, hitter friendly. So, you know, chances are, who knows where they'll send him if he signs. My guess would be Grand Junction based upon what I know and what I've seen. And if he performs there, either they'll leave him there for the season, because remember, he's still 18 years old, or there to Boise for a taste of it at the end of the year. But either way, it's just crazy stuff, man. And you know, you talk to people about, oh man, isn't this great? And I said, you know what, this is the first time they've been doing the first year player draft for 54 years. This is the first time in the history of New Hampshire that a position player has been drafted in the first round.
It's a big deal.
Chris Carpenter is the only other one. He was a pitcher, of course, to be drafted in the first round. So, it's kind of like waiting for an eclipse. Like, don't think this is going to start happening every year.
No. Enjoy this while you can. And
right.
Like you said, Monday, 4 o'clock in Manchester, state championship against Exeter.
So on the lacrosse side of things, the boys, you were there Saturday. Our friend Ryan Toscano and his squad lost 10-9 to Londonderry. They were up 9-5. The Lancers scored 5 unanswered goals. Ryan had a good shot late, is what you're saying?
Yeah, it was, tough loss, but exciting game. Last couple minutes, Bedford got some quality shots to try and tie it up, including Ryan. He was kind of heading towards the middle, and he went with a bounce shot that just barely went too high. Freshman phenom Dawson Clark had a couple great opportunities. And the team, they called a couple timeouts, so you could see the strategy and, you know, trying to get that game time goal that was just elusive, unfortunately.
And for the girls yesterday, they lost the state championship to BG 10-9, gave up the game tying goal with 38 seconds left and lost it in overtime, 2:18 remaining in OT. So a rough ending for the girls to cap off their season. So with that, quick little recap. Of course, Little League is in the midst of playoff mode. We'll go into that another time. But we'll take a quick break. Be joined by Sports Illustrated legal analyst Michael McCann, listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox, Andrew Hansen, and it's rare, first of all, that I have two attorneys on the air at the same time, but we're going to do that in a second. And rarer still that we have somebody who fits tidily into a current event that's going on right now. So we have Michael McCann, who's Sports Illustrated's legal analyst. He is one of the deans at the UNH School of Law. And in light of some current events that are going on in the world of sports, Michael, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, Mike, before we get to the breaking news about Brian Colangelo, we want to talk about your book that you just published. It's called Court Justice, The Inside Story of My Battle Against the NCAA. And it's a book that you wrote with former UCLA basketball great Ed O'Bannon. And what the book does is it describes a class action lawsuit regarding the rights of college athletes to be able to negotiate and receive compensation for the use of their names, images, and likenesses. Now, what was it about this case that motivated you to team up with Ed Bannon and write this book?
Sure. So I covered Ed O'Bannon's trial back in 2014, and during the trial, I interviewed him. And over the years, as the case went on, I got to know him. And then when it ended, with the Supreme Court declining to take the case on review, Ed came out to the University of New Hampshire School of Law and gave a great talk about the case. And during that time, we talked about sort of future plans, and we got talking about a book. And through that conversation, we decided to write a book together. And I interviewed Ed during that process quite a few times. And his book, Court Justice, came out earlier this year in February. And it's really a remarkable opportunity to talk with an athlete who's taken on a very powerful case, and he won.
Yeah, he sure did, and it was fun. During your book tour, I was able to come out and see you at the UNH School of Law with Ed and his wife, and you guys did a great presentation, and you told some stories about all that back and forth that led to you completing the book together. And I love how the title of the book, Court Justice, has those two meanings, and you mentioned how they did prevail in court, and did so at the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Since they were able to prevail in the Court of Justice, how has the landscape of the NCAA and amateur athletics changed as a result?
So I think the big change is that students can now get the full cost of attendance. This is something that the NCAA changed their rules on during the course of the litigation. Very basically, it allows college athletes to get, it depends on where they're in school, it depends on cost of living, there's a variety of factors, but $3,000, $4,000, or $5,000 per year that they didn't get before. And that is a change. That is a result of Ed bringing a case that required the NCAA to think about its rules about how college athletes are compensated and whether they ought to be compensated for their name, image, and likeness. So that, to me, is a big change. And then, of course, there have been other cases that have come up that I think have built on Ed's case with the general goal of providing more resources to college athletes and trying to make it a fairer playing field.
Yeah, and one thing you mentioned in the book is, in addition to the ability to negotiate about names, images, and likenesses when you're talking about a trade association, because athletes are not considered employees right now, so they wouldn't form a union. But looking into the future, would it be possible for a trade association to bargain with the NCAA about some of the other aspects of being an NCAA athlete that you discuss in the book, like receiving health care, being able to transfer to a different school without having to sit out an athletic season, and potentially receiving compensation for their services like an employee who's part of a union?
So it is possible. I don't know whether it will happen. I think there are a lot of factors that have to go into it. It's not clear that college athletes on their own would form a trade association, but they could. There are certainly entities that would push for that. And then there's the issue of whether colleges and the NCAA would have discussions with such an association, that they may prefer other vehicles of advocacy on behalf of players, but that remains to be seen. So the answer is college players could form a group in which they use that group to advocate for change. But I think there are practical hurdles that would have to be overcome. including the fact that I think a lot of college athletes are so focused on what they're doing in school. I think all of us can empathize, right? When we're in college, the idea of being in an association to advocate for larger change while balancing that with courses and, in the case of athletes, athletic stuff as well, I don't know. I mean, it's something that the practicality of it we'd have to see. But certainly, I think what we will see, if it's not a trade association formally, but there will be more athletes, I suspect, advocating on behalf of players, and we've seen that happen in recent years.
Here with Mike McCann, who recently wrote a book called Court Justice about the Ed O'Bannon situation, a lawsuit back in 2009 where O'Bannon, a former player, sued the NCAA. And a topic that comes up fairly frequently is whether college athletes should be paid. Do you believe that they should be compensated other than just for the use of their names, images, likenesses? And if so, how would a system like that function?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there, right?
So you could spend hours talking about it.
Yeah, you could spend hours. I think it's a question that's really important. I don't think we'll come up with a solution, in a conversation. I think it's going to require a lot of due diligence. I think it weighs the fact that there are very different kinds of colleges. There are colleges that make a lot of money on sports, clearly. I mean, look at how much money is spent on coaches. You have coaches making over $10 million a year. You have training centers that are pro quality. There are all sorts of ways in which it's clear that a lot of money is being generated through college sports, but you have a lot of other schools that are not making as much nearly, and the athletes at those schools are not necessarily generating revenue. So I think any kind of system of rules that would pay players a salary or a stipend, however way it's configured, would have to be thought out really carefully. There is a case called the Jenkins versus NCAA, which looks at issues of whether or not athletic scholarships can be capped by the NCAA. In other words, should the system be set up so that college athletes could get market value athletic scholarships that wouldn't force a school to pay them, but it would give schools the choice? I mean, it's an interesting concept, and I think that will be part of the discussion.
It's certainly a complicated thing. And yeah, you brought up the concept of the haves and the have nots in college. There is a lot that goes into that, and not all colleges are created equal. What really makes it work in professional sports is some element of revenue sharing, whether it's TV deals, whether it's a salary cap, something along those lines. And college, putting a system like that in place, given the number of Division I schools, logistically sounds like an absolute nightmare.
I mean, I think it's doable. I think it's challenging, right? I mean, we've figured out a whole things as well. We figured out landing on the moon. I mean, I think it can be done. I just think it's something that will take a lot of time and perhaps, have schools think about having conferences that are set up in more pragmatic ways that not focused just on location. I mean, focused on what is their economic capacity. So there are lots of aspects to this, but I think it's safe to say it's not something that can be solved easily.
Right. It's a complicated thing. And so I know Hanson's been foaming at the mouth over in the corner here, waiting to hit you with some Brian Colangelo questions.
Yeah. It's funny how in your book, Mike, you entitled chapter 3, Trust the Process. And then ironically, less than an hour ago today, we're taping this on Thursday afternoon, the news came out that Brian Colangelo had agreed to resign from his post on the 76ers. Last week, you wrote a detailed article on the controversy for SI.com. And we know that you're on deadline here to write another article on the most recent news. But what's your initial take on hearing that Brian Colangelo has decided to resign?
Well, I think it's probably the most likely outcome. I don't think it's a big surprise. Once it became clear that he had some connection to the, or at least alleged connection to the Twitter accounts, and the current thinking is that it was his wife who created the accounts and tweeted, it put him in a compromised position because it suggests that he shared confidential information to his wife that was then broadcast across the world. It's professionally really damaging. So I'm not surprised that he's resigned. I mean, I think it was sort of the likely outcome once there was any link between those accounts and him.
Yeah, it did seem hard to imagine that this would end any other way. So we'll look forward to your article on that. One of the other big recent articles on SA.com was how you broke down the U.S. Supreme Court decision that now allows states to offer sports betting. And we're curious if you have any insight into what you think might happen, in New Hampshire in terms of what our lawmakers might do in this field moving forward.
Well, I'm sure there will be. I mean, I've seen some comments from some representatives talking about considering legislation that would authorize sports betting in New Hampshire. I think New Hampshire, like all of the states, are going to be thinking about this topic. Some states have already moved forward, Delaware being the first, and New Jersey's on the verge of doing it as well. But it's also something that's not instantaneous. There'll be hearings, there'll be debate. So, I mean, I think patience is going to be a key word here, because there will be discussions about what kind of games can be bet on. Is it just pro games? Does it also include college? Does it include Olympics? Does it include every sport? How will the money be distributed? Will there be a tax that goes to the state? And if so, where does that money go, if there's any set place for it? Do leagues get a so-called integrity fee? Do they get a cut? I mean, there are all sorts of, you know, complexities to it. But I think there'll likely be a strong movement in the state to at least explore sports betting, and especially if other states adopt it, New Hampshire might do it as well.
Yeah, you mentioned Delaware. They were in a good position already being grandfathered in. And funny story that came out was how the governor of Delaware placed the first bet there this week, and he bet $10 on the Phillies to beat the Cubs, and he was successful. So before we let you go, we know you're a big basketball fan. We're going to let you have a chance here at a pretend wager. Golden State's looking good, up 3-0. So do the Cavs get this past Game 4 tomorrow night? And then maybe a little tougher prediction, do the Celtics win the NBA championship next season?
Yeah, I don't think I have any great insight on what's going to happen. I wish I did. I'd be a rich person, but
especially now that gambling's legal.
Yeah, right. I think the Cavs have played tough, right? I mean, every game they've tried. They're clearly Golden State's the better team, but I'd like to think Cleveland can pull out at least one win, so that they're not swept. I think their pride will be on the line. Getting swept in the NBA Finals is, will certainly be a hard thing to take in. So I think they'll eke out a win. I could be totally wrong. Celtics next year, we'll see. I think they've got a good shot of getting to the NBA Finals, but you look at how good Golden State is, it's really hard to envision any team beating them.
Yeah, they have done the proper mix of homegrown talent and expensive free agents, and that whole KD thing really swung the pendulum in their favor.
Yeah, no question about it.
So one more question on Brian Colangelo, and this is coming more from a layperson than anything else, and you and Hansen touched upon it. Is there a potential that there might be HIPAA violations for disclosing some of the sensitive medical information?
Probably not. The Department of Health and Human Services has opined on this issue of pro teams and HIPAA, and the takeaway is that it likely doesn't apply. So probably not on that front.
I would have figured that if it would have applied, Bill Belichick would have used that as his rationale for not disclosing anything a long time ago.
Yeah, right.
quite the likely story. Well, Michael McCann, we appreciate the time. We know you're on deadline, so good luck with the article for SI.com. And if you're listening to the show after the fact, be sure to log on, visit SI.com, and check out articles from Michael McCann. And don't forget, he's a New Hampshire product. He's at the UNH Law School and specializing in sports law. So, Michael, thank you for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Take care.
Back here on Fox on Sports, Bedford 105.1. It's my name's Lauren Fox. That's Andrew Hansen, by the way. It's interesting, though. We came back to record this next spot, and you immediately touched base with me on the amount of time we had left to record and what we were going to talk about next.
Imagine the audacity.
And we're not even getting paid for this, but we check in. Hey, we're going to do this. We got this much time. This is what we're going to do. Turns out that that's not what everybody does, I guess.
No, it's weird. I mean, especially when you're competing. So I mean, strange. This is just us, you know, kind of doing our normal thing here, right. Our weekly thing. We're not in the NBA finals, but if we were, man, we would certainly be paying a lot more attention to time and all the details that go into what you're involved in. You know, time,
right.
Score, where you are on the court, where's the basket. You know, these are important things to keep in mind when a championship is on the line.
Right. You might want to keep that in mind. What we're referring to, obviously, is J.R. Smith.
Game one.
And it's just a bummer. I like J.R. Smith. I have always enjoyed the fact that he's an eccentric. He says what's on his mind. I'm always entertained by he's an avid golfer. I'm always entertained by guys that are really good at one thing and also really good at another thing. It takes a certain kind of mental focus to do that. So of course, what happened was J.R. Smith standing at the free throw line on the block gets a rebound, which was in and of itself like the unmentioned. If he hadn't done a great job getting that rebound, we're not having this conversation.
Yeah, 4.7 seconds left. And, oh, by the way, Kevin Durant did not box him out.
Right.
Kevin Durant, who's much taller than him, much bigger wingspan, if he gets into him and actually boxes him out, we're not having this conversation.
Right.
Golden State gets the rebound, and they push down with a chance to win it. Who knows how things would have turned out. But instead, you're right, he made a nice athletic grab, and then things just went haywire.
Yeah. So things didn't go well for our buddy JR. He dribbles out to pass the 3-point line before he finally chucks it to George Hill in the corner, who misses a three that's partially blocked. The game ends. LeBron James becomes apoplectic about this whole thing. And then they're sitting on the bench later You know, like I've said it before, and I defend LeBron, but what you can't do in that circumstance is head and hands, kick back, eye roll. I just did that. That's why my voice got quieter, because I tilted my head back like that. But you just can't do that. Like, you're the leader. Like, you do that, and your team all goes in the fetal position, and you lose by 10 points in overtime.
Yeah, there was just so much to impact there in those couple of minutes, because you mentioned what J.R. Smith was doing, running out and then turning around and passing it to George Hill. Of course, what was LeBron doing? First, he was calling for the ball potentially to take a wide open three. Then he was directing J.R. Smith to go back the other way and, you know, either go back and shoot it or go back and pass it. You know, we need to score here. Time is running out. Then he makes a timeout motion himself with a second or two left, and the timeout is not called. So you think from watching that clip that LeBron thought they had a timeout, and so he tried to call at the last second. But then what was interesting about that situation on the bench was, like you said, what led to him putting his head in his hands and having a very demonstrative reaction is it looked like he asked Coach Lou, did we have a timeout left? And Coach Lou must have said yes. And then LeBron had that crazy reaction, which makes you think, well, so LeBron apparently wasn't sure that they had a timeout.
And again, there are a few things. I go back to Hoops League. We come out of a timeout and everybody is, okay, we only got one left. We don't have any more. Like,
That's not a secret.
It's not a secret. And particularly in the NBA, where you have no shortage of timeouts.
And you have no shortage of coaches who are telling Coach Lou. I mean, one of the jobs of an assistant coach is remind Coach Lou, how many timeouts do we
right,
have?
Right, everybody's got a job.
Does a guy have five fouls?
Right. So it's funny. I was watching footage of Andre Iguodala talking to one of the Warriors, and he has become, when he's not in the game, he's like a de facto coach. And you really, like, there are some guys you say that guy's going to be a coach in the NBA. He is one that I feel will be a coach in the NBA. Just has intelligence, intensity, the right kind of mix of things. But he's sitting there talking to a player, and I don't remember who it was, giving chapter and verse on this is what you should do. And one of the assistants is standing about a foot behind and might as well have been checking his watch. I'm like, who's getting paid to be a coach and who's not? Or is this guy just a water carrier?
Yeah, and then the assistant coaches for the Cavs were sitting behind the bench during that timeout, not saying anything. Everybody sort of had that ghostly look on their face, and nobody was saying anything, looking at each other. Jeff Green and Tristan Thompson eventually came in and tried to cheer people up a little bit, but that was just an emotionally draining moment for the Cavs, and it seemed like once overtime started, they had absolutely no chance.
Right. Well, that, and then the LeBron yells at J.R. Smith, and J.R. Smith says, I thought we were ahead.
Right. The cameras caught that.
Yeah, and then J.R. says after the game, no, I knew it was tied. Man, if you knew it was tied, then why would you dribble 30 feet away? It's funny. I haven't heard anybody defend him, but I can understand the mental calculation that he went through of, okay, dude has two free throws. If he makes both free throws, we're ahead by one. He just forgot that little detail of if he makes the second free throw or he misses the second free throw, we're tied.
Right.
Minor detail. It's forgivable.
Oh, yeah, of course. So that was game one. Game two wasn't very close, and the highlight of that game was Steph Curry's amazing shooting. So we're going to highlight something positive from game two. Here's what Steph did. Backpedaling Steph steps into backcourt on Swish. Rainbow of riches. Ray Allen's corner. Steph ties his record with eighth. Midsection love tap. Toying with Osman. Steph's ninth caps game two, three game, 3:33 left. So Steph Curry broke the record, broke Ray Allen's record by making 9 3-pointers in an NBA Finals game. And I think it was 5 for 5 in the fourth quarter. So this was a game where he was kind of chugging along, shooting under 50%, you know, not really having a memorable game. But then he just caught fire.
And then he just started hitting weird shots.
Yeah. I mean, the seventh three-pointer that he made, he took it from probably 7 or 8 feet behind the three-point line with Kevin Love in his face.
Off balance,
backpedaling. And when the ball went through the basket, he was standing in the backcourt. That's how far away he was.
And it's the, I don't know, you can compare it to a punt return in the NFL where, I guess, first of all, if I took that shot in a men's league or even in a pickup game, people would be screaming at me. But yeah. I'm not Steph Curry. The second thing is it reminds you of a punt return in the NFL who catches one deep and everybody's yelling, no, no, no. And then the second it becomes apparent that he's going to break it, it goes from no, no to go, go. It's that.
That's one of the stories of Steph Curry. And thankfully, for everybody's sake in Golden State, Steve Kerr is fully supportive of all the decisions that Steph Curry makes. I mean, you know,
he's earned that.
Yeah, he's earned it. And he said, you know, you got to let Steph shoot it when he thinks it's a good shot. And, you know, occasionally he would certainly acknowledge that Steph maybe makes some careless passes. You know, he gets on the team when they make too many turnovers. But in terms of Curry shooting it, you got to live with it. I mean, he's like you said, he's earned it. He's proven that, you know, he's probably the best shooter of all time in NBA. And he knows what's a good shot and how to get himself going. And he, you know, he carried the team down the stretch there in game two.
Yeah, so it has been fun to watch. It's been a weird series. It doesn't feel like it should be 3-0, but I heard somebody describe it on ESPN earlier this week. What Cleveland did in that game one basically made it so that in order to win the series, they had to win 5 games.
Yeah.
Because you had a game that you should have won. There's no doubt about it. And because you lost one that you should have won, now all of a sudden you're in a position where you theoretically have to win 5.
And what's crazy about our conversation right now is we've gone through games 1 and 2 in some detail. We haven't even mentioned that LeBron in the first game had 51 points, 8 rebounds, and 8 assists. Just an incredible performance. And we also haven't mentioned the other controversial play in game one. 36 seconds left. Cleveland's up by 2. Durant comes hurtling down the paint. LeBron slides over in front of him, and the referees look at each other and call a charge. And Cleveland is set to get the ball back up to with 36 seconds left. But then they decide to go to instant replay to, quote-unquote, check and see if LeBron was in the restricted area, even though he was clearly
right, it was
10
obvious.
To, 10 to 12 inches
out of there. Yeah.
Yeah, not even close.
Yeah.
But they used it as an excuse to go to the replay booth, and that gives them the opportunity with this little-known and rarely applied rule that under those circumstances, if you're going to review to see if he's in the restricted area, you can reverse a call from a charge to a block or vice versa.
I like instant replay. And as a matter of fact, I don't like instant replay when it wastes time. But Rick Muntean, who we had on, was party a few years ago to me and a guy named Brian Williams trying to come up with, we're before baseball did instant replay when it was still controversial, we were going to roll out instant replay in a Kansas City T-Bones game. And we had the circumstances that it would work in, and we got from the league office, you guys can't do that. And that one died on the vine. We did play at one point, we were going to play the last two innings of a game on an Xbox. So the game would end at seven innings. And then we ran a promotion with CompUSA, had two people down in recliners. Major League Baseball put the kibosh on that one. They said it has to be basically what happened was the game ended, and then we wound up replaying the last couple innings. But the goal was that the stats would count, all that sort of stuff. The instant replay thing to me is the way that that rule is applied. It's like, let's say if you were driving on the road and it was only between the hours of 5 and 7 that you could get a ticket for running a red light via a photo. The rest of the time, a police officer had to be there. That, to me, is the same application of it. The NFL does the same thing as well with, they're so fastidious with time in the last 2 minutes of the game. Please reset the play clock if it's 1:56. Please reset the play clock to 1:58. And you go, they're worrying about 2 seconds now, but there's time earlier that they let 15 seconds run off the clock and nobody bothered to say anything about it. And that's always driven me absolutely insane. And you look at something like this and you say, if it's a charge block, which is, first of all, I don't think that's something you can replay, because that is a bang bang. And I realize a play at first base in the major leagues is a bang bang too.
But that's not a judgment call.
That's not a judgment call.
That's safe, black
it's
or white.
Safe out. The interpretations, I felt like we were talking about the Tuck rule with, oh, LeBron shifted his shoulder in such a way that made it look like he was scratching his armpit. Like we're defining a catch in the NFL. Either it's an instant replay item for all 48 minutes in overtime, or it's not.
Exactly.
But it does not deserve in that 2 minutes. All right, we're going to stop time now. And again, no secret. Like, I'm a LeBron guy, although I do think he can be a little bit whiny at times. I think he's a heck of a player. The problem that I have is either it is or it isn't. And there's no reason those last 2 minutes are any more special than the first 46.
Right. And if you can allegedly be reviewing one thing and in a certain circumstance just notice that there's a foul, then exactly, why can't you do that for all 48 minutes? I mean, if, you know, you're seeing that, okay, was it a two-pointer or a three-pointer? And, you know, then you see that there was a foul or there wasn't. Why not just have it be that when you go to the replay area, you're reviewing the entire play?
Right.
Okay? All the rules of basketball, they're in play when you're reviewing it. Okay? You're looking at the play again, and then you're just going to make the call that makes sense with everything that you're seeing, whether it's a flagrant foul that comes out of nowhere that you didn't even know it happened, whether it's inbounds, out of bounds, two-pointer, three-pointer, charge, block. Just go over there and get the play right, and then move forward.
I think games will take about 4 hours. Where I would limit it is, no, a charge or a block is never a we're going
right.
to review it
judgment call.
No. It's 100% judgment call. Any hand foul, anything along those lines, no. What should be is two-pointer versus three-pointer. Inbounds, out of bounds. Flagrant, yes, no. Like, flagrant is hard to tell. So is that, was it just a personal foul? Was it flagrant one, flagrant two? Okay, that's fine. Those are reasonably cut and dried. where you'll get into an absolute mess is, was it a travel or wasn't it? And was it a travel for him or was it a travel for him because he was Euro-stepping?
It's like in the NFL, you don't have replay on pass interference, right? Then the game would literally take five hours.
Oh, yeah.
So they're smart enough to say, no, we're not doing the judgment calls. We're doing stuff that's more black and white. But thinking of football, one of the great things they do, of course, is with the challenge flag. The coach throws the flag onto the field, and boom, you know it's a challenge, and then you can go review it. And it got me thinking about this timeout situation. Wouldn't that be a nice improvement if there was some way for a coach to call a timeout when play is happening at the end of the court, none of the referees are looking at him, but he wants a timeout? I mean, that was a critical juncture in the game. What if Ty Lue wanted a timeout with 2.5 or 3 seconds left? What are his options? He has to literally run down the court to get a referee's attention. What if it could be that he throws a challenge flag onto the court and then everybody knows, okay, he threw it with 2.5 seconds left.
He's trying to get a timeout.
Right.
Yeah, he's just, yeah. That'd be logical. A buzzer. Yeah.
Right, anything.
Hook him up with the collar that my dog wears. The officials get that.
Yeah, yeah, just
get
a little
they
buzz.
Get zapped if they don't issue the timeout. The zap lasts longer.
Yeah, it's like a little, they've got a beeper on their hip, and you buzz the button, they get a vibration, boom, you know it's a timeout, play stops.
Beepers are not manufactured anymore, I don't think.
I mean, you hear about it throughout the playoffs multiple times. It happened with Steve Kerr earlier in the playoffs where he said, no, I was down at the other court, I was trying to call a timeout, nobody saw it. I mean, this happens a lot in the
NBA.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's one of those things that I go, yeah, it's a part of the game, but it shouldn't be a part of the game because your success or failure as a coach should not be predicated on your ability to get the attention of the zebras on the court or the guys who work at Foot Locker or whatever. So, yeah, it's I don't know. Here's the other thing that all this stuff has gotten me thinking about. The amount of controversy that exists, I feel, on a daily basis in sports. I feel like we've gotten to a point of critical mass where we are constantly, whether it's sports, whether it's politics, whatever, we know that it's like a moth to a flame. You know that it could end your life, but it's still so attractive. We want to be able to see it and be part of it. The controversy is a thing. I think everybody really doesn't care for it all that much. And Stephen A. and we have 1,000 reporters we're going to ask for different hot takes. And most people just would rather just watch the guys play the game and think about the did they win, did they lose, and not break it down to the nth degree of the nth degree. But that's here we are.
Yeah, it's a tough balance between wanting to get it right so that, you know, there's justice on the court. Of course, I'm still thinking about Mike McCann's book. You know, there's a balance between wanting to get it right and knowing that, you know, players' success, coaches' job security, front office members' job security can depend on the outcome of one play. You know, in this day and age with the technology that we have, a lot of people have gotten more and more accustomed to, okay, we'll make a small sacrifice here with time because of our technology to get this right. And it's a balance that's just going to continue to play out in each sport. You know, every season, each sport looks at these things and considers different tweaks to try and get that balance between sacrificing some time to make sure we get it right.
Yeah. Well, I remember back when guys would get penalties on the in professional golf majors for putting down a towel that nobody saw, but somebody saw it on TV and calls the TV station. The next thing you know, guys are retroactively given penalties.
Oh, that drives me crazy.
Yeah, it's, yeah. Just
because the rules of golf don't make sense with the physics of the world. You know, these rules about, okay, if you step on some grass or your club hits some grass,
can't change your life.
3 inches away from the ball, and that somehow makes the ball move just a millimeter, then you should be penalized. It should be about intent. You know, if it's, and that's hard to judge, but
right.
You can, you know, that's one of those things that you can golf is a game of ethics, and you can trust a player who, you know, he says, no, I'm not trying to move the ball there, so no harm, no foul. And then when you can have people watching a telecast on CBS or Golf Channel, NBC, and then call in and say, hey, I saw this, and then a golfer gets penalized one or two strokes, that, I think, you know, has it going a little bit too far.
So speaking of golf, good segue. I'm going to pat myself on the back. some might know him as the throw-in in the Doyle Alexander trade in 1984 that got the Tigers the World Series title. He actually pitched up here in Manchester years ago when he was with the Red Sox doing a rehab start back in 2009. But John Smoltz is not just a baseball player. And I guess if you read the stories about Smoltz, Glavine, and Maddux back in the day, like, those guys were hardcore golfers. Glavine was a hockey player who was drafted by the LA Kings.
Yeah, tremendous athletes in that Atlanta rotation. And you always heard stories about them with their battles on the golf course on their days off. And what an amazing accomplishment for John Smoltz to qualify for the U.S. Senior Open. He's 51 years old, and he shot 3 under par in regulation, had to go to a 3-way playoff, and a couple holes in, he manages to survive, and he did so with a double bogey, which is surprising. So his competitor had scored worse than a double bogey, but you know, like I said, he shot 3 under in regulation, so this is nothing to scoff at, and he's going to be in the U.S. Senior Open later this month in Colorado.
So, yeah, it's interesting to see Smoltz doing that. Nice footnote to his career. And, of course, if he was I don't even know what you call it, a regular professional golfer, he'd be young or he'd be old. But for a senior golfer.
Perfect. You know,
he's young.
You know, you got to be 50 to be on the Senior Tour, Champions Tour, and he's 51. So he'd have a lot of good years ahead of him.
Yeah, so
to go up against Bernard Langer and the rest of the crew.
Yeah, I enjoy that. I enjoy seeing the names that are on the leaderboards, and then the guys that you've never heard of who hit their peak late or somehow have cruised into it. So, yeah, best wishes to John Smoltz. U.S. Senior Open, what was it, June 28th to July 1st out in Colorado?
Yeah, and of course, like we said, he's 51. As for the 31-year-old who made golf news, another great story of a long shot qualifying. Garrett Rank is an NHL official, and he just qualified for the regular U.S. Open as a 31-year-old. And what he did to get there was he shot back-to-back 71s, which were 1 under par. And really kind of interesting about this is that another one of the NHL referees, Daniel O'Rourke, was his caddy. So you got two NHL referees out there teaming up on the bag, and Rank is able to qualify for the U.S. Open, and he's had a history of playing golf at a high level. He's from Canada. He played in college. He played in the 2016 Canadian Open, finished 77th in that, and he also was a runner-up at the U.S. Mid-Amateur Championship. So, you know, he's really taking advantage of the schedules because, you know, he referees all winter, plays golf all summer.
Yeah.
And that's what has allowed him to make this great story.
I mean, it really doesn't sound like a bad existence at all. The fact that he's able to do that, spend his life around sports and yeah, I'm jealous.
he earned it. You know, it's not easy to go out and shoot 71.
Right. That's the thing. I mean, that's the beauty of the U.S. Open is that Tin Cup can get there. All you got to do is win the qualifiers.
That's right.
Or finish high enough in the qualifiers and you can go. But of course you have to golf at a certain level to qualify for the qualifiers. And then if you happen to not be good enough at the qualifiers, you also get the letter from the US Open saying, or from the USGA saying, are you sure that you're really that good? I didn't do that. I had a buddy that happened to. Great golfer. He's an accountant. We'd go out. He was like a +2. Like, I shot the best round of my life. I shot an 81. And my buddy Junior went out. Not the Junior who everybody knows here, but My buddy Junior went out that day and shot a 66, like legit. And I mean, we breezed through the course in 2 hours. Like,
so he was a legit plus two.
He was a legit plus two and went to qualify for the U.S. Open at Mission Viejo Country Club, which Johnny Miller, former, well, I think he's still an analyst, but he was a PGA Tour pro, referred to as Mission Impossible.
Wow, and that's saying a lot.
Mission Viejo is a tough course. I mean, there's a lot of elevation changes. The greens are absurdly fast. Like, I was hot. I was happy. I played it years ago with a client. I was happy to be under 100. It was absurd. It was like a house of horrors of golf. But so my buddy Junior goes out for the U.S. Open, shoots an 88 in Mission Viejo, just couldn't putt. And within about a week, got a letter from the USGA saying, if you plan on qualifying for the U.S. Open in the future, you might want to prove to us, documented proof, that you're actually as good of a golfer as you say you are.
Wow.
Otherwise, yeah, we'll take a pass, pal.
Jeez.
Yeah. But, I mean, Junior came through after that. It's funny. He probably could have done something with it. He took the PAT, passed the PAT. He used to be our ticket. He worked at Pelican Hill. He worked at Riviera. We'd get to play all those places for free. But he probably could have been a golf instructor, but he loves playing too much. And if you're an instructor, you're helping other people with their game. You're really not helping yourself.
That's right.
That's the hard part.
Yeah, especially for that short game. You got to be playing all the time if you're going to play on a course like that. I mean, that's saying something. If Johnny Miller calls it Mission Impossible, this is the guy who analyzes as if every shot, you know, should be made, sort of expecting
that's his job,
almost expecting perfection, you know, never really cutting guys much slack at all. And for him to say that there's a Mission Impossible out there, that's saying something.
Yeah. So crazy news on the golf world, and finishing up where we are as far as the NBA title, Washington Capitals, who knows by the time we're done, may have their first Stanley Cup, long due.
That's right, because Game 5 is tonight. We're taping this on Thursday. Capitals have taken charge of this series after losing the first one. They've run off three in a row, gotten just great balanced play from Ovechkin and Kuznetsov and Holtby with some great saves. And Vegas is going to have something to say about it tonight.
Yeah.
Hopefully they'll prevail so we can get a little bit deeper into this series, at least get to a game six. And, you know, if Washington were to win it, they'd be winning it on their home ice, which would be quite a celebration for DC.
Yeah. The interesting thing for Braden Holtby is how the mental aspect is played into all of this, visualization, watching tape, the things that players are able to do now that they weren't able to do back when, where Holtby can go through and watch almost a supercut of his entire game. And you know, you can condense that. I think they condense him down to about a 20-minute video, give or take, where he's watching saves and is able to dissect, I didn't make that save based upon this, and he's watching tendencies of players and all that sort of stuff. When you realize that he is performing at the level that he's performing at, some of the saves that he's making, you go, God, how did he make those? He wasn't even looking. Well, he's seen it before. And he's relying, and it's the visualization aspect, the ability to know, okay, what a guy's tendencies are, and therefore I need to have my blocker here, I need to have my glove here. That has made him into a better goalie. And you look at the advantages the professional athletes have over the rest of us of they have therapists, they have tubs that they can get cold in, get hot in, people who tape them after every game. I remember, and you know it because you played ball, you get onto the bus after a game and the pitchers would, from basically shoulder to elbow, be encased in ice.
Yeah, and with that clear plastic wrap.
Clear plastic wrap over them.
You can mold an ice pack to any area of your arm that you want.
And I've never had one of those in my life. But the advantage that a player has in recovery simply by having a trainer work on them after the game, take care of them like that, all right, send them on their way. They wake up the next morning, they feel a lot better than we do. And the advantage that a Braden Holtby has of, he doesn't have to sit there and edit it. Or, hey, mom, you took video of me doing X, Y, and Z. Can I watch it on my phone? He's got a guy who edits it, uploads it to Huddle. He watches it on Huddle. Bam, he's ready to go.
Yeah, those are a couple of things that have allowed athletes in all sports to take things to a new level. you know, with the video side of things, it sort of helps so much with your preparation that you feel confident, you know what to expect from your opponents, and you visualize how you're going to react in the certain situations. And then it allows you to free up and have the instincts to make a play like he did back in game two, where he just spun and made that amazing
right.
save with the paddle of his stick. And then physically, you know, man, hockey players need that.
Yeah.
They go through what a grind they go through
yeah.
every game, skating so hard, and, you know, not to mention all the bumps and bruises they get. You know, they got to have the complete training staff and, you know, massage therapists and ice baths to be able to compete at the high level they do to with the Stanley Cup on the line.
It's a lot for those guys to do, so who knows? We'll see what happens with the Caps and see what the final of the Cavs-Warriors is. We'll know that by the time we're on the air next week. So
I'm going to do what LeBron and J.R. Smith should have done. I'm getting the sense that we're towards the end of the show.
Oh, yeah, we are.
Yeah. Oh, this is how you talk yeah. out timing and all
yes.
that? Yeah. So I want to give...
You see the panic look in my eyes, like, oh, my God, dude, we got
to
stop.
I want to give one more thanks to Michael McCann for joining us.
Boom.
If you haven't checked out his articles on SAI.com, I really recommend you do that. He has an incredible aptitude for taking a complex legal situation and breaking it down into very understandable language and concepts, and it's just a joy to hear him speak and read. So we thank him again for his time, and, you know, look for his articles on SAI.com about Michelangelo's situation.
And also thank you to everybody who takes care of us here at Bedford 105.1. Harry, Bill, Colleen, and Chris, once again, and thank you, listeners, for putting up with us for an hour. For Andrew Hansen, I'm Lauren Fox. Have a wonderful sports week. We'll catch you next week. You've been listening to Fox on Sports.